Hello, hello. So happy to be here with two of my favorite world-renowned gut health experts, Dr. Allison Seebecker, and then our dear, dear friend, Dr. Satish Rao, who is coming to us live from Augusta, Georgia, who is just hot off the press from DDW, Digestive Disease Week, the largest gastrointestinal conference in the world that happens in San Diego every year. And he has some observations, some controversies to discuss, some exciting announcements. And it's such a pleasure to be with both of you today. I'm Siobhan Sarna, by the way. Hi, let's talk gut health. Hello.
Thank you so much for joining us, Dr. Rao. We're so happy to have you and hear about what you presented and what you have to say from DDW.
Well, thank you, both of you. It is really a pleasure and an honor to be back on your wonderful show. And it's so nice to see how this show has grown, how many people listen to it. And really the best compliment for all of you is how many patients of mine have heard all of you and really understand, your efforts in educating them, bringing them up to speed with what are the latest thought processes, the scientific discoveries, and also bringing in a whole host of experts in different areas, all related to gut health, and then, sharing in a easily digestible manner, if I can say that kind of information. So thank you for the wonderful service you're all doing.
Well, we appreciate being able to get you out to the people. We need to get more information from Dr. Rao. We have plans for you, sir. Big plans. So tell us about your observations about DDW and this capsule as well. Very exciting.
So I think there were several interesting things that were going on in the DDW. And of course, as you mentioned, one of the exciting thing was really about this vibrating capsule. So this is a technology that was developed in Israel almost about 10 years, 10, 11, 11 years ago. And they've been toying with this idea of delivering a capsule to the gut and use the vibration mechanics, very simple mechanics, very much similar to what we all have in our cell phone. Remember, our cell phone vibrates. There is a little motor that vibrates inside a cell phone. It's a very similar kind of technology. But I think the goal really is if you really make it too strong, then it's going to be very irritable, and it'll become unpleasant. But then to draw this very fine line between this becoming something repugnant or intolerable to something that is both tolerable and has a prokinetic effect on gut function. So that is what it took them almost 10 years, if you like, in terms of development. I mean, it's not easy. They've been playing with a number of parameters, and you can only change one or two parameters at a time. How frequently this should oscillate, how strong it should oscillate, when should it oscillate. And then there's the battery, right? The battery runs out in these devices and so on. So doing all of this and the cutting a long story short, then they embark on this journey. Then how do you measure constipation? This is a little challenging. In some of their early trials, they were not very successful with measurements because they were missing the mark. Cutting a long story short, eventually, I think they, with their experiments, they then how often should you be giving? Should you give one capsule a week? Should you give two capsules a day? I mean, if you look at any pill, most pills you take it once, twice, or maybe three times a day. So should you be taking capsules like this? So all of these. And also, one of the big questions, what time of the day should you be taking this capsule? Now, when we give our constipation medications to many of our patients, one of the things that sometimes makes it challenging for some patients is, oh, I like this drug, it works for me, but it gives me unpredictable bowel function. So they sometimes take it in the morning, and then, by 2 o'clock, 3 o'clock, they get a strong urge to go, but they are in the middle of teaching or they're middle of an active job. So that then becomes a little challenging for them. So consequently, they will then say, oh, they will try to stop taking it and they don't know how to do with this, or they get adverse effects. So really, timing and the number of other parameters were all very critical, as well as how to measure. And that took an evolution of several years for them. But then they designed this new study about 3 years ago with the FDA's blessing, where they also, how do you design a sham capsule, right? Now you're talking about placebo capsule is easy, but the sham, meaning that you have to have a capsule that is going to vibrate. It has to vibrate because the way this capsule is programmed is you take the capsule out of a blister pack, you put it in a what is called as an activation pod. So when you put the capsule in the activation pod has electromagnetic signals and a computer program. It sends those signals to that vibrating capsule and it kind of imprints on the capsule how the capsule should function. It's all done momentarily, but
this
very
is
fast.
What it looks like. I don't know if you guys can
right,
see the
screen. Right. Oh, okay. Great. Yes. Yeah. So you see the capsule, you see the pod. The pod has all that activity and the hub inside it. And then it actually sends all of that program into the capsule. The capsule is now programmed. It's a matter of seconds. And as soon as that happens, then the capsule is ready to be swallowed. The patient swallow it. So, but you don't, in a constipated individual, you don't need, I love those drawings, by the way, the constipated individual, you don't need for the capsule to be active in either the stomach or the small bowel, but it has to be primarily active in the colon. So if the capsule becomes activated, let's say it's in the stomach and it's done, then it hasn't done its job where it's supposed to be doing the colon. So we had to figure out how to really activate it. And so they went with two paradigms based on all their previous work. One, to activate. So everybody swallowed the capsule between 9 to 10 the night before. And the following day in mode one, the capsule was activated at 2 p.m., which is roughly 16 or 18 hours after capsule ingestion. And then the other one was roughly at 6 a.m., which is like about 8 hours after capsule ingestion. And the rationale was that, you know, when we wake up in the morning, our colon also wakes up, and that we can prime and work on this model and improve colonic function. But we didn't know, and when we started the trial, which of these two modes, one is called mode one and mode two, was going to work. And also this trial was built with the FDA's consent in a model called drop the loser arm, which means you can start the study with two modes, which are the active modes and one placebo mode. But then after you've enrolled X number of patients, the Data Safety Monitoring Board is then given the privilege of reviewing this data and then directing the researchers to only pursue one of those two active modes, whichever they think is both efficacious and safe, rather than both modes. And then they run with that mode for the rest of the study. So this is what happened. Essentially, the mode one, which was where the capsule would get activated the following day at 2 p.m., was the preferred mode, and they completed the study using that mode. And at the end of the day, they measured what we call as number of complete spontaneous bowel movements per week. And the FDA criteria is, you know, in 75% of the trial duration, which is 6 out of 8 weeks, they should be more in each week, there should be more than one complete spontaneous bowel movement to qualify them as a responder. So if you then go back and look at their end result, they found that close to 40% of patients who were in the vibrating capsule arm were responders. They had more than one complete spontaneous bowel movement per week in 6 of the 8 weeks. As opposed to 22% in the sham capsule arm. So they had a delta of almost 18%, which was favorable to this. But the interesting study, what they also did was as part of the primary outcome measure, they had two primary outcome measures. One was increase of one complete spontaneous bowel movement, and then the second was increase of two complete spontaneous bowel movements per week. No drug or anything has previously ever used that as a benchmark, because it's a much higher benchmark to reach. But these guys were bold enough to proceed with that. And lo and behold, they reached that benchmark too. And it was like 11% in the placebo and 22% in the vibrating capsule arm. So both primary outcome measures were met. But that was the efficacy part. But the nice thing about this was the safety part. Literally, no adverse effects. Literally, no adverse effects. About 10% of patients reported a vibrating sensation. Only 10%, not the remaining 90%. But that was not strong enough or anything that said, oh, I don't want to participate in the study. No, they continued to participate in the study. They didn't withdraw from the study. But no diarrhea, no nausea, no headache, you know, other things that we see quite commonly with a number of other pharmaceutical compounds that we all use. So this was really what we're seeing for the first time, a non-pharmacological, safe, efficacious approach using a capsule. Now, they don't have to take the capsule every day. It's 5 days a week. That's how the study was done. So Monday, Tuesday, Thursday, Friday, and Sunday. Remember, in Israel, Saturday, Sabbath day, so they don't take a capsule. I'm just kidding. But that was not quite true, but it was Monday, Tuesday, Thursday, Friday, and Sunday were the 5 days they took the capsule. And study was done in 95 centers across US, and it was very successful. So that was one of the important take home.
One quick question, and maybe, sorry, my roofer just drove up and he isn't supposed to be here till tomorrow, so I had to go deal with that. But are they pooping out the capsule? How do you recapture the capsule?
No, they just poop it out.
So you get a bunch of them.
Yeah. So they just poop out the capsules, and that's then it is not reused or anything like that.
Okay.
And it's wow. so that was the main. Go ahead, Allison.
Wow, this is amazing, because we actually just had our colleague Dr. Kimball, long time in practice, focusing on chronic constipation. She gave our audience a masterclass on chronic constipation and was exactly discussing. She was mostly discussing outlet dysfunction, which I know you did a bunch of lectures on that and treatments for, such as biofeedback, which we want to hear about in a minute. You did that at DDW, but she was mentioning that, you know, there's a certain percentage of chronic constipation patients that it's like nothing really works for. And that is exactly what you began this article with, is that that's why this was developed and who it's targeted for. And that's just really incredible news, because patients and doctors have been frustrated by this group we can't help. And this is incredible news, you know, really.
Yes, thank you. Yeah, that is what I think it is. You know, there is the survey after survey has shown that roughly half the population of constipated patients are dissatisfied with current therapies for various reasons: safety, efficacy, tolerability, predictability. These are some of the reasons that people have actually talked about. Whereas this one now probably gives them that little control, more predictable. It is clearly efficacious and appears to be very safe. So it is important. You know, also I need to add to that although this will be widely applicable, there are some conditions I think we should be very cautious, because this is people who have difficulty swallowing. I don't think they will be eligible to take this, because if you have swallowing problems, you should be taking capsule. People who have had major gut surgeries before, or have had a history of adhesions and bowel blockage or obstructions, I don't think they should take it, because the capsule is likely to get stuck. Unlike a pharmaceutical pill that'll dissolve, they just need to be a little cautious. So those are some groups I would be cautious about. But otherwise, I know, I think the vast majority don't have this condition. So this should be a new approach, I think, in really managing these difficult problems. Then we can talk about the outlet obstruction condition whenever you're ready.
Please.
One last question. When do you think the FDA is going to clear it?
So great question. So we are all waiting to hear. I believe the application is currently pending with the FDA, and they are hoping that somewhere in August or September, they will hear. So that's very, I mean, it's imminent. It's not like, you know, a year away or something like that. So the application is pending. Remember, the FDA has multiple divisions. It has the pharmaceutical division, and then it has the device division. So this is with the device division.
Cool.
They don't have a large portfolio to review, unlike the pharmaceutical division. So I think they may get a more expedited review, I think. But I think the company folks are hoping definitely they will launch this product before the end of the year. That's what they're looking at.
And we hope insurance will cover it.
Yeah, I think so. That will be the next thing. I think they will have to face that battle and everything. They will be also important. Is education is going to be important because this is slightly different, because it's a device, and you know, patients have to learn that it's not difficult. But they I think in that very nice picture that you showed, mm-hmm. there's a cell phone, right?
Yeah.
And that cell phone was very useful for the clinical trial, because the patients had to log in, and daily they had to answer questions about how many times they pooped and so on, and it generates a report. This was also used to look at their compliance issues and calculate the complete spontaneous bowel movements and all of that kind of stuff. Now, in this study also, in real life, they would like patients to continue to use it. They know not everybody will use it, but they expect a proportion, maybe 50% or more would use it. So you can now, for the first time, get real-time data about usage of not only their device, but also how impactful it is in real time in the community, rather than in a clinical trial setting, right? In a clinical trial, you know, you monitor everything very carefully. But once a drug is approved, etc., we really have not much feedback other than any safety concerns. If safety concerns become significant, then that is brought back to the FDA's attention and they will investigate. But here we really also, they're looking at really monitoring real life to see, you know, what happens to them if patients can use this electronic diary through the cloud, I think, to convey information. So it'll be interesting to get some real-time information on patients' satisfaction, dissatisfaction, tolerability, etc., and usage and compatibility. So we'll learn a lot, I think. We also might learn, you know, although we ask patients to take tablets a particular way, patients do them differently. Yeah. So although here the capsule, it is based on the study, it's going to be 5 capsules a week, but maybe patients are only going to take 2 a week or 3 a week. Yeah. So we will learn, I think, how patients are using the treatment and what is it meaning to them? Is it effective, ineffective, so on? So a lot more to learn, but real-time data will inform us better.
Exciting. All right, Allison, you had your question about the...
I just want to hear, I know you gave several at DDW. I was watching virtually, so I did not get to see all of the recorded meeting. You know, not every meeting was recorded to watch online, but I know you gave a discussion on a case of pelvic floor dysfunction and constipation, and also a discussion on the challenges of using biofeedback for treatment of those cases. And anything you want to tell us, we'd love to hear.
Oh, great. Yes. You know, it is another important and often neglected area is this whole issue of pelvic floor dysfunction. And, you know, it is a common problem. More than 40% of patients with chronic constipation have a pelvic floor dysfunction. And the exact reason why they develop this remains a little mystery. But the best way to put it is they have either a third of them never learned the art of pooping right from childhood. Something didn't work properly. And 2/3 of them had normal pooping behavior during childhood, but something happens later on in life that then changes their behavior. I'll give you a couple of examples. Someone has had surgery into the anorectal area. It is very painful, so it's hurting, or they've developed a chronic fissure, a chronic anorectal condition. then they're going to change their behavior. Or someone have had a surgery to the spinal cord region or whatever. So things like that changes the pooping behavior. And now they've learned a new behavior. This new behavior is no longer conducive for normal pooping. So unbeknown to them, they're not even thinking. They think that they are having an urge to go. They're going to go sit on the toilet and try and poop. But they are not relaxing. And in fact, they're paradoxically contracting their anal sphincter muscles, or they're unable to generate the push effort to pass to. With this, they have developed this incoordination or dyssynergic defecation. And I think some people, I coined the word dyssynergia. I mean, medically, that's the right term. But a lot of people are criticizing me appropriately. What a mouthful of a word. I cannot say this. This is dyssynergia. What's terrible? So I feel so. I'm sorry about that. But I think medically, it is, you know, coordination is synergy and incoordination is dyssynergy. So I think that is the right way to call it. But I'm sorry that I have to use a word which is so much mouthful.
Hey, I just want to say I've never had a problem with the word dyssynergia. So there you go.
You do it. You say it beautifully. So, but so then, you know, we with time, we were able to really develop a treatment using physical therapy means. Of providing feedback to the individuals, if they can learn what they're doing wrong first, and second, if we can show them different techniques, breathing techniques, posture techniques, pushing techniques, over six sessions or so, they can, you know, totally relearn the whole process. And 80% of patients, at least coming to my biofeedback center, they all get better. So we've been able to show that very consistently in multiple studies and so on and so forth. But here is the big challenge that we are left with, and that is we don't have good tools. There are lovely guys and girls, you know, particularly our physical therapy colleagues, really try and do a great job and service. But everybody's handicapped because we don't have tools. What have we done? I mean, what have I done? I have a tool called anal clinometry. I have a probe with multiple pressure sensors. And that is the tool I use to study the muscle function, rectal sensation, everything else. To do biofeedback, I have adapted that tool. Use literally the same tool, but now instead of doing diagnostic testing, I'm using this to provide me feedback information about pressure changes in the rectum and the anal canal. And that feedback information, I'm then using it to educate the patient and correct the dysfunction. But this tool was never developed for biofeedback purposes. And there is no good treatment program to teach them. So we have been kind of dabbling in this for year after year, which has been a really, to me, a frustrating thing. You know, I am more a clinician. Yeah, I wear my physician scientist hat and so on. But quite often we rely on our industry partners, device developers and manufacturers to help us. But sadly, they have failed us, repeatedly failed us. I mean, I've been telling them for year after year, guys, help me. And in fact, at my talk at DDW, I gave an analogy. And the analogy was, you know, we have a tool for measuring esophageal function. Okay. And that probe is about this long. Okay. Like 30 centimeters long. Now, we can use that same tool to measure anal rectal function. But in anal clinometry, we only need about a 6-inch probe. Why do these companies make a separate probe for anal clinometry? Why can't we use the same tool? We are doing exactly that in biofeedback. You know, we have a different tool developed for a different purpose, and we are adapting it because of lack of dedicated tools and the lack of dedicated feedback. I think it is okay to do it when we are starting this whole thing. You know, when we have to prove the principles, is just something work? You know, we need to show this. It's fine. But it's 20 years since the discovery. We're still using those crude tools. We're not providing proper feedback. And, it is so silly that some of the feedback tools that we have, of course, are pressure waves, right? Now, you and I and Siobhan, you know, we have a little part of our scientific brain. We understand physics. We understand lines. a line going up means pressure going up, a line going down means probably pressure going down, and so on. But just think about our poor patients. I mean, they have to connect, oh, line going up means pressure going up. But I'm pushing already. What do you mean pressure going up, pressure going down? They're confused like hell. So, you know, what we need to provide is something more simple, more realistic, right? Everybody knows that the rectum is like a little tube. They know there's a muscle, anus muscle, that normally is closed. That part, most people understand conceptually. So what we need to show them is, hey, when you're pushing, your rectum kind of contracts. And as the rectum contracts, the anus opens. And then that leads to coordinated poop moving out of your body. I mean, simple concept. But if you are not able to show that concept in a realistic fashion, but instead show them lines, it is a hard thing to cross. I mean, I'm not saying it's impossible. Many people are able to connect, but it's a tough thing. So we need the tools and we need the feedback mechanics to improve so that we can really improve this treatment modality. So we are still struggling. We have a very early hint. I think after being frustrated with this, I think some one small company vendor has taken on this challenge of trying to develop something more realistic very early. I don't know. We'll wait and see. Maybe in the next year or two, if this thing really translates into a beneficial tool. And if it does, I think it will help so many people with this condition. A more realistic, dedicated, purposefully designed biofeedback tool. So
your passion is the best ever, because this is exactly what we need and want. You know, patient advocates, you know, and this is, you know, we are advocating for better tools that help us with our patients. And this is you are the example of what we need in this field. So thank you so much for all the awareness raising you're doing to get these tools, you know, and this passion brings me to another subject, which is when you told Siobhan and I, you'll come on and tell us about DDW. You said there were some controversies. And what were those that you wanted to discuss?
Yes, thank you for asking me about that. So we had an interesting session on dysbiosis, on small intestinal bacterial overgrowth, and so on. And I was a little intrigued, perhaps a little disappointed, I would say, with some of my colleagues in the field. The premise was there were two or three areas where I thought I would distill it down to. Number one was the use of the term irritable bowel syndrome synonymously, if you like, with SIBO, small intestinal bacterial overgrowth. And so there was papers, etc., being showed, meta-analysis being showed, saying that, you know, these doesn't make sense. Not all IBS is SIBO. And that was one of the controversy. Another area was about the lactulose breath test, that this gives false positive results. And I think there is some good science backing that up. But at the end of the day, the message that was being relayed, which is where it bothered me, was that the concept that SIBO is not a true medical condition.
Huh.
And that many of us are making a story out of nothing.
Now, I do not understand how that could be scientifically supported.
I think that is what they were hammering down, and it was, I would tell you that normal circumstances, I would have normally got up myself and have really, you know, said my two cents worth. I did not do this for one important reason, because I was the next speaker in that session. I did not want to get myself very ruffled out before I would go up on the podium. So I was just taking my deep breaths and kind of calming myself down. But the good thing is a very good, I mean, is a friend and a colleague of mine. And I'm just, for this moment, I'm just forgetting his name, but he is the chief of GI at Baltimore in a community hospital, well-known community hospital. He's also, I don't know whether you ever had him on your show or not, but he is a big microbiome person, a gastroenterologist. He has one of the largest stool microbiome repositories that I've ever known. He's probably got 3,000, 4,000, 5,000 poop samples on patients. He's done a lot of work on C. diff and also some on fecal transplant and things like that. And he continues to do work. So he got up and I thought he made the best point. And he said, you know, I heard all of this. This is not a field I usually work with. You know, I don't do research on SIBO. We do some breath tests in our lab, but I don't do research. But let me just cut through the chase and ask a simple question. I see a lot of patients who come with significant gas, bloating, etc. We either do some tests or we may not do some tests. But then I treat them with antibiotics. And then they come back to the clinic and say, Doc, that was a miracle. All my gas bloating has gone away. You see it, I see it. You want to call it IBS, you want to call it SIBO. I don't honestly care what I want to call it. This is a real thing. And this is what we do and helps them. So is that not the case? Is what is questioned. And the answer was no answer.
Aha. This is exactly my point. I have colleagues in, you know, in more of the alternative field, you know, that also bring up arguments about who actually believe in SIBO, right? But don't like that it's called that, want to call it this, want to call it that. In the end, I say, you call it whatever you want and whatever name is agreed upon, fine. I don't care. What I care about is getting our patients better.
You got it. Absolutely. That, I think, is, you know, the sad thing is in medicine, people get hung up on nomenclature, on this and that. But you're missing the big point here. I mean, these are people who are suffering. And, you know, we are trying to help them. Okay, granted, we're not always right. Okay, and there is some room for speculation, et cetera, but we are at least trying, you know, to find scientific basis for their symptoms and then trying to develop scientific approaches of treatment for them. There's nothing wrong with that. And we are helping them. Hey, if we are really harming all of them, okay, I would walk away from that. I think that's not right. But so, I mean, it was really bizarre. So I think my takeaway from that was, I did contemplate a little bit, and I think I had a brief meeting with Mark and also with Ali about this a little bit. And I thought,
Dr.
you know, Pimentel maybe...
and Dr. Rezai, just for both
Dr. Rezai, yeah, Ali Rezai. So I thought we should maybe think a little seriously about two issues. One is, I think the time is right now that we, as leaders and scientists in the field of SIBO, start detaching SIBO from IBS. I do not think it is fair to call SIBO IBS. I mean, you know, years ago, just to give a simple analogy, which you are already aware, lactose intolerance was called IBS.
Right, exactly.
Right, and then once lactose intolerance was discovered, nobody calls lactose intolerance IBS. I mean, we call it lactose intolerance.
Right, it's IBS.
I think the time is right. We detach SIBO. Right. Why go after IBS? I mean, we will never win this battle. So best is to stand on its own legs. This is an entity. We all accept it. We have ways to prove it. This has to become an entity. Don't tag it. Don't say, oh, IBS patients have SIBO. Forget about it. Detach. Yeah. SIBO is SIBO.
Right.
They have gas, bloating, diarrhea, constipation, distension, and positive breath test or cultures or whatever. That's what it is.
And it needs
a small interstellar dysbiosis, right?
It needs its own ICD-10 for this to...
Exactly. We need to push in that. And otherwise, you know, we'll always be bogged down. And I think the second one is really the lactulose breath test. I mean, it is constantly keeps coming out. So I would say, you know, let's de-emphasize the lactulose part. Focus on glucose breath test. Nobody questions the glucose breath test. If you want to use a breath test, until there are better tests, I'm not saying. For now, let's detach it and let's not focus. I think if we can do those two things, I'm sure newer tests are coming up, right? I mean, we've talked about, I don't know whether at Siobhan, we talked about the Progenity capsule once before.
We've touched on it briefly. We don't right. the name
I think,
it.
You know, and whatever, wherever they're coming up. Then this Australian company with this ACMO capsule, they wanting to come up. And maybe we should have a discussion about these capsules another time. But what I'm trying to say is, you know, there are, just like this vibrating capsule we talked about, there is an evolution towards non-invasive, more accurate, mm-hmm. more specific targeted diagnostic techniques. And maybe one day we will give up breath testing because we'll have better tests. I mean, it's okay. Our right. goal is ultimately to help our patients. So we will use those testing. So that is coming. I mean, it's not within the next 3 to 5 years, I'm sure they will be there. But let's not kill the field. Because the field gets killed. I mean, what are these techniques going to do? I mean, so I think we need to really make sure that these are real patients and not say that this doesn't exist. To me, that was the part that I thought was really a little controversial.
Well, strong calls to action as well. And Dr. Seebecker, Dr. Rao, thank you so much for this powerful, powerful conversation that leads to more questions, but lots and lots of answers. And Dr. Rao, we look forward to working with you again in the very near future. We love you.
Thank you.
So much.
Thank you. Oh, that was a lovely discussion. I didn't even know the time passed. I'm looking at it. It's 1 o'clock now already. Well, that's great. That was wonderful.